A Sickness in Time by M.F. Thomas and Nicholas Thirkettle. Narrated by Roseanne Sinclair. Chapter 18. Anna Louise's greatest asset was her confidence. With my business savvy and success, it said, would I ever back a losing horse? As the meal wore on, though, Josh began to sense a trend behind her smooth delivery. She was sticking strictly to the surface of the issue, avoiding technical details as much as possible. In other words, Anna Louisa wasn't making her own pitch. So Josh waited for the rudest moment to interrupt her and then redirected the conversation as bluntly as possible. This is Caslick, isn't it? You're working for him? Anna Louisa cleared her throat slightly. It was a heck of a poker tell, but one she covered so quickly that only someone as familiar with her mannerisms as Josh would have caught it. Off balance, she slipped into one of her strongest modes, calculated candor. That was obvious, wasn't it? Look at it from my perspective. There's something happening here that I really believe in. I believe it's important, that it will help people, and that the only person who can get it done is you. Do you know how long you've been railing about Caslick? Anna Louisa cast her eyes up at the ceiling inside, which was a lovely detail. As long as I've known you. I don't know if it's some kind of projected guilt, but nothing puts your walls up faster than the mention of his name. And it was just too important that I at least get you into a conversation before that happened. Okay, so you fed me and you flattered me. Do I have to wait until dessert to find out what you two want with me? Josh, she paused before a bite, letting something on the end of her fork drip as she regarded him. You really do look different. We worked together for so long that I didn't notice all the little changes. But now that you've been away, I can see it all over you. You're an adult now, Josh, not a child genius anymore. So negotiating with little tantrums just doesn't suit you. Not at all. And then she crunched back into her food. Josh didn't reply. He felt the pressure in the room, the way she had preemptively cast this move on his part as its own sort of tantrum. There was no question she was better at this game than he was. But so far, that fact hadn't been a problem. Josh, Anna Louisa continued. You've known me to be tenacious and sometimes secretive. But have I ever told you an out-and-out lie? No, you haven't, Josh said, dutifully providing the answer in her sales script. Then know this. Mr. Caslick's organization did approach me after your speech. They showed me some proprietary data, stuff that could cost them billions. It was a great gesture of trust. And the conclusions that they've come to are every bit as startling and urgent as what you're proclaiming, only they show something completely different. Kentron Gray is not a plague. It's an awakening. Josh nodded. The attack on his network had given him a sneak preview of this argument already. One that may have been designed to soften him up for this very moment through a kind of implanted confirmation bias. Evolving, not dying. That was you guys, right? Anna Louisa nodded, candor still fully engaged. Yes, we hoped you might do your own research into the idea, but you stayed committed to your insane mission. It's a theory. A rhetorically appealing one. Certainly a convenient one for Caslick. How comfortable are you with the murders he's committing using this? Josh mimed air quotes. Great awakening. Anna Louisa shook her head and used her best look of disappointment. Then she went back to darting her fork around her plate. I asked him about that the first time we met. Your assassination virus is a theory too, isn't it? I mean, you've tied together a whole lot of stories from the news in a very thrilling way, but you've never proven anything beyond your own paranoia. But he took the accusation seriously when I put it to him, so he showed me something. With impeccable timing, Josh didn't even know how she'd signal for it. An underling brought in a pad and presented it to Josh. "The room is network shielded," she continued, "but everything you'll want to see is on the in drive." Josh expected the worst. A picture of Minjun lashed to a torture table. Sierra. Anything involving Sierra. What he found instead were equations. The surprise was so disabling that he found himself absorbed despite himself. He scrolled through pages and pages of numbers and symbols and lines of code. Even someone of his expertise couldn't see the intent of the language just from looking at it from this perspective, and yet it fascinated him. The way an art connoisseur might enjoy just ignoring the whole picture to concentrate on the brushstrokes for a little while. His finger started to trace interesting bits. "Can I?" Ana Luisa finished his thought. "A simulator is loaded on the pad. Play with it any way you like." The same underling came back with a luxurious old coffee pot. He filled Ana Luisa's cup and she settled back, sipping with deadly patience. After who knew how long, two cups of coffee drunk slowly, Josh looked up with a face scrunched in frustration. "It's nothing. It's a dead end. You can push it any which way and nothing coherent comes out of it. What the hell is it? You want me to try to fix it? Because I'll tell you right now, I can't. It's a mutant Kludge baby descended from three generations of Kludges before it, masquerading as some kind of obsolete delivery protocol. It's sprawling. Swiss cheese. Totally useless." "That's what you see?" she asked. Her cup was poised near her lips, and every part of her radiated anticipation. "Is there something else I should be seeing?" "Funny. They say a parent can always recognize their child. Josh, that Kludge you describe is your virus." Josh's eyes locked back down on the pad, and he zoomed out so no individual piece of code could be read by human eyes. He looked at the thing as a whole, as if he might recognize it shaped like a portrait in a silhouette. This would never work, but no rational reaction had occurred to him in the shock of the moment. "I'll make it easy for you. There's an option to swipe it back one generation at a time. Try that." Gradually, Josh stripped away layers of code, detached routine patches, searching for something that he hadn't seen since he first crafted it in an intoxicated haze. Several steps before he reached 1.0, he started to recognize it as his own. Gawky, wildly ambitious, built on great, gaping presumptions and unresolved conflicts, but revolutionary in potential. Here was a better portrait of Josh's adolescent self than any school photo could hope to present. All bounding ambition and wild, egoist vision. Ana Luisa continued. "That's the great killer mind virus that the brilliant young Josh Scribner created, which was then stolen by a young Spartak Kaslik. I gather he wanted to buy it from you, but he had suffered a financial setback. But even if he didn't give you money, you robbed him blind, as it turned out. This is your concept, plotted and premuted out as far as the best minds on Earth besides your own could take it. He made a very expensive industry out of trying to develop this concept because he believed in you, and in his younger days, he thought it could be useful. I am under no illusions that he's ever been a saint, but he's been legitimate for a long time and it has softened him. Of course, I don't understand any of the technical side, but Kaslik told me that I wouldn't need to, that once you saw it, you would understand. It doesn't work. It never did. Josh stood awkwardly. I think I'd like to lie down. I haven't been sleeping well. Ana Luisa showed perfect concern and compassion. Of course. Thank you for coming this far with me, for being willing to participate. I know how difficult it must have been for you. Take the pad with you, if you like. He was lost, without bearings. The dinner had been a rout. Ana Luisa had given nothing away and had dismantled all his mighty assumptions along the way. Despite his fatigue, he spent 3 more hours examining the extrapolation of his virus, checking the work every step of the way, looking for unexplored paths or signs of fakery. He couldn't find any. There was no way to know for certain. He would have needed months of time and massive computing power to simulate it all from scratch. But it certainly seemed that the assertions Ana Luisa had puppeted were true. That Josh had never created a virus at all. It was a strange thing to reconcile. On one hand, a great burden of guilt had been lifted from his shoulders, one he had carried so long that he had forgotten what it was like to live without it. On the other, he couldn't deny that there was a strange element of wounded pride. Coming up with a world-changing idea on a stoned whim was a part of the private legend Josh lived with, an anecdote that helped him define his greatness. Although the use of such power made him recoil, the godlike nature of the power was too alluring to not take credit for. Had that been what drove him in his crusade? The need for the great conspiracy to be true because at the heart of it was a confirmation of Josh's own genius? What other surprises did they have for him? He realized the danger of his position a little better now. He had never been good at taking comfort or reassurance from other people, and now he felt more exposed than ever and had no one around he truly trusted. He, Josh Scribner, was in the midst of being hacked, and on one level of consciousness, he could see it all happening. He was vulnerable now to new suggestions, new frameworks, new instructions. What he had known before was, in the coldest language, no longer operative. Finally, he slept and he dreamed. He saw a city emerging from a rip in space, a scar among the stars. That wound was the foundation, and skyscrapers extruded from it as though invading. They pushed further and further into the universe. Josh's vision zoomed in and around them, glimpsing people moving at blinding speed, flowing around the city system like electrons through wires, up to the tops of buildings, down again, and all around the floating city. Lamps switched on and off in windows. Whole buildings flickered bright and dark on cycles, days seeming to pass in seconds. The people make the lights, Josh thought. It was an obvious observation, and yet it thudded at him, refusing easy dismissal, suggesting deeper meaning. The people make the lights. The speeding, luminescent cycles rippled. The lights were a traveling pulse, in some ways predictable, but infinitely variable in the details and always evolving. The second cycle was very much like the first. 10 cycles along, you could barely recognize how the initial pattern was connected. The buildings grew further and further. They strained their dimensions, becoming strangely fat, obscenities against architecture. They twisted, bent, crashed through each other. Incredible progress was becoming incredible obliteration. And yet, in that black vacuum, it looked silent and serene. No more shocking than any other natural inevitability. The lights kept flashing on and off, but faster now, brighter. They made a frantic visual music as the great metropolis moved towards its final collapse. Josh tried to take control of his movements. If he could circle the city, he could swoop amongst its towers. He could catch the fallen like a superhero, wrench the towers out of each other's way. But he had no command. He hovered in the blackness, just watching. The whole industrious endeavor was being sucked back into the place it had emerged from. Josh strained to feel the fear for the people he had glimpsed inside the system, but he couldn't find it. And yet, he did have a fear, one that was familiar, but that he never acknowledged. A feeling he'd never considered to be a feeling at all, because it had fused itself so deep in his core that he had never seen it as separable from his essential self. The fear was not what would happen to everyone else, but that he wasn't a part of it. He wanted to be sucked in, even to be destroyed if that's where humanity was headed. If the choice were put to him, he knew what he wanted. Death. Death over being a lonely observer in the void. But he couldn't go, and he was doomed to be apart. He woke up from the nightmare feeling better rested than he had in months. A man and a woman sat in separate rooms divided by a wall. They wore identical medical scrubs, and their heads had recently been shaved. Each room had sparse but quality furnishings, books, puzzles, and controls to play music. There were also supplies of food and water, and a private area for toilet needs. Both rooms could be observed through a single wide pane of one-way glass. The man and woman didn't utilize any of the provided entertainment. Instead, they made faces. The woman paced her room while the man just sat in a chair, but both appeared to be going through the same process of spontaneous reactions to what? They look like they're in a conversation, Josh muttered in the dim observation room. The exit door was guarded, an unnecessary courtesy. Part of Josh still wanted to escape, but he was curious to know whether the situation called for an escape or sabotage from within. For that, he needed more information. And if he was honest with himself, he also wanted to know what the hell was going on. Ana Luisa smiled. They are. They're talking to each other. This snapped all the behaviors into focus. The reactions on the subjects' faces were playing off of each other. A disarming smile produced a warm softening of the facial muscles, perplexed interest turning into mutual delight. It moved faster than a normal conversation would, and seemed far more intense, judging by the shameless gyrations of expression they were each displaying. It was mesmerizing. For a few minutes, Josh could do nothing but take it in, insatiably curious about how the conversation might be translated into words, if that were even possible. Another part of him was envious of the experience, of this new form of intimacy. Conversation fully consummated mentally. Josh leaned in closer to the glass, studying their faces. I see a scar on him. They've both got beetles implanted. The glass was powered for display. Ana Luisa summoned patient profiles for both the man and the woman and then slid them towards Josh with the flick of her finger. Have a look for yourself. Josh paged through the records. Some of it was medical jargon, but he understood the broad strokes. They were Ketron-Gehry patients. Yes, both in middle phase, when the medications can't tamp things down anymore. They were unable to work and looking at a short and horrendous downward spiral. They sought out beetles because of the folkloric belief that they could help. Josh threw her a dark look. She continued, "They do, you know. They provide stability, a slowing of symptoms, increased quality of life. But then something else happened with these two, and only these two. They started talking with one another, beetle to beetle, mind to mind. You're looking at living proof of your wildest theories right here." The man made a playfully stern look. The woman stopped pacing and her mouth rounded and expanded in a silent, joyous laugh. "What are they saying to each other?" he wondered aloud. "We ask them to keep journals and report on the conversations. What we get back is always vague, cursory. Words can't capture it. Naturally, or it's possible they can't even recall the ins and outs of these conversations via normal memory. We're talking about very, very new uses for neurons here." "It's funny," Josh mused. "I think when people speculate on telepathy, there's always this fear that the other person will see your dirty secrets, your darkest impulses, that any true glimpse of another person would be repulsive." Ana Luisa shrugged. "If two people get naked in a room, they're tense. They fear judgment. 50 people naked in a room are just people, flaws and quirks and all. None of us are totally free of darkness in our natures, but our minds are alive. We can drive them. That creates our personalities. I think they're getting a much richer version of what we already sense from gestures, humor, style, etc. Pure personality. Minds want to connect." Josh remembered the words he used to sum up both his speech and the perils and possibilities of it all. "So is the spigot open all the time? Are they just linked for life now?" "We don't believe so. Or rather, they seem to have ways to withdraw from each other. Watch." She brought up a command menu on the glass and pressed something. A chime rang in the woman's cell and she responded to it. A look flashed across her face, which the man answered with a nod. Josh realized how quickly he could find analogs for these looks. The woman's was uncanny, like, "Sorry, I have a call." She approached an intercom and said, "We?" Her voice was pleasant but flat. Her face ceased its delirious show of feelings. Ana Luisa spoke a bit with her in French, then bid her a pleasant day. The woman stretched out her arms, looked around the room, and then tilted her neck in a particular way. The man decidedly heard it and, with a relieved grin, resumed their conversation. "She's French?" Josh asked. "From Africa, actually," Ana Luisa answered, "and he's from Germany." She smiled at the chance to share a truly killer detail. "They don't speak a word of each other's language." Josh's voice was quiet with captivation. "Of course, linguistic forms are culturally imposed. They shape thoughts but can't fully define them. How many others have you found like this?" "These are the only two that we know of. They could be one in 10,000, could be one in a million. Their brains just found each other. They were separated by two floors in the medical clinic and had never seen each other face to face as far as we could tell. And they started talking anyway. And the more they talked, the healthier they got. Look at the records." Josh obeyed and paged through report after report, including video supplements. The patients in the videos were miserable, plagued with tremors, without equilibrium, nothing like the joyous pair in front of him. Ketron Gary is the adaptation process, he said, finally accepting the idea but putting it in his own words. It's cultivated by signals put out by the Beatles, but it's not, my God, the capacity this suggests. With the Beatles to regulate the process, these two have made a leap. All the data in the brain of one is available to the other. Images, sensations, even things like if the other's heart is beating too quickly. And it does appear that some privacy and concealment is possible, something that could be developed further with practice. And you want to know the really stupefying thing? She dangled the question just at the moment Josh found the answer in the records. He scanned the page twice and then stared at the subjects in front of him, absolutely agog. You took them out. Yes. We deactivated hers for diagnostics. As you can imagine, we were seeing whole new categories of signals and we couldn't tell if it was malfunctioning. Sometimes it seemed like something was spontaneously switching itself off, letting go like something vestigial. And nothing changed. They carried right on conversing. He even helped us monitor the surgery. He could report what her body and brain were experiencing even while she was under anesthesia. Once we found they could converse without hers, we deactivated his as well, purely for experimental purposes. They never needed them again. We took them out, the connection remained, and they haven't shown a trace of Ketron Gary since. Their evolution finished. So the process is underway. All over the world, it's underway. For a few moments, all thoughts of time travel were ejected from Josh's mind. They were like an old car he'd used for so long that he can only see its flaws and difficulties, whereas this new circumstance, this new mountain of revolutionary, powerful data that so few people in the world would know how to climb, it stimulated everything in him, including, most dangerously, he knew, his pride. Could the process be refined, disciplined? How could people be screened for compatibility? Was his brain alphabet truly universal, or did it differ along the genetic spectrum? He was seduced for longer than he was proud of. And then he spoke a number. 5 million. We passed that casualty milestone with Ketron Gary last month, I think. So, at best right now, you've got 2 miracles and 5 million dead bodies. It isn't like you to rationalize something like that, Ana Luisa. Not at all. Nobody knew what was happening at first, Josh. Not even you. But you said it yourself. The process is underway. Like when the ocean started to rise, you can't put it back. People are dying and they will keep dying. But this is the real answer as to why. And with this answer, we can save more lives. Guide the process. Steer the human race towards connection and healing. Or we can try to buy back and deactivate every beetle, stop the signal in its tracks, and treat every Ketron Gary case conventionally. I assume you've seen the mortality figures on that approach. You know people, Josh. We don't move back. We move forward. The only question is, where are we going and how will we get there? With you, we'll get somewhere better, and more of us will reach that destination. And that, in answer to the question that's been on your lips since you saw me here, is the message that I am here to convey. Josh wiped away all the files and formulae that had littered the glass since they had begun talking. Instead, He watched the German man and the African woman in their respective rooms, making a mockery of the drywall that separated them. The man had a jigsaw puzzle open and was just running his fingers around the cardboard edges of one piece. Her fingers were rubbing together in the adjoining room, but doing what? Experiencing the touch with him? Seeing the shape of the piece and assisting him to find its place in the big picture? No one but these two would ever know. A Sickness in Time by M.F. Thomas and Nicholas Thurkettle, narrated by Roseanne Sinclair. Learn more about the novel by visiting www.sicknessandtime.com. If you've read A Sickness in Time, please leave a review in Amazon, Goodreads, or other book review sites. I'm Roseanne, host of the California Dreaming Podcast, a true crime show that delves into the darker side of California. Join me each week as we take a tour of the beautiful beaches, majestic mountain ranges, expansive deserts, and soaring redwoods to discover some of the most chilling, fascinating, and depraved criminal acts that have taken place across the state. You can find California Dreaming on all of your favorite podcast directories, including Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and Stitcher. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or you can visit our website at www.orbitaljigsaw.com and click on the show's link to find hours and hours of true crime tales from the Golden State. Thank you, and sweet dreams.